It's real different when you're hosting it.
Yeah. Okay. I believe we are recording. One second. Hello, this is Jonathan Coleman, and I am interviewing Jean Donahue for The Country, Remembering Lexington's First Lesbian Bar. The date is November 23rd, 2020, and I am at 2650 Bowman Mill Road in Lexington, Kentucky. Thank you, Jean, for talking with me today. As we start out, could you spell your first and your last name for us?
Jean Donahue, Donohue.
Wonderful. And where are you currently located?
I'm in Portland, Oregon.
Portland, Oregon. That's a long way from the country. So, thank you, of course, for doing this. You know, we're really interested in getting your memories, not only of the country, but also of the community that surrounded that bar. And really, let's start before the country, a little early biography. If you could, tell me a little bit about growing up. Where's your hometown? What was it?
Well, I grew up mostly in Louisville. I'm an Army brat, so we traveled a lot, and we finally, when my father retired from the Army, we landed in Louisville, where my mother's aunts lived and where most of our family was, Louisville Horse Cave. I went to school at always nomadic Fern Creek Junior High and Seneca High in Atherton, and graduated in 1970. Took a year, worked for the census, made a little bit of money, and then went to school at the University of Kentucky. And after a year or two at the Jefferson Community College. So ended up in Lexington for a while. Spent a year and then went back to Louisville and married my high school sweetheart, and was married for 3 years, and decided married life wasn't really for me, and decided to go back to UK, and finished as a kind of a late bloomer, and as my last six credits of my art history, bachelor in general studies in art history and film criticism, I did my last two courses in Paris because I had made a friend there, and he allowed me to come stay at his apartment in Paris for 9 months for me to do this independent study. And I think of interest to this is, you know, you never know what you're doing when you're younger, but one of my research projects was the Ecole de Fontainebleau, which featured a number of paintings that, from my perspective, was lesbian content. There was lesbian kinds of overtones. And so I did this research project about that. My professor thought I was nuts. But as part of that trip, I made friends with some Italians, and I was able to visit in Torino for an extended period of time, and ended up going to some underground arts events. And at that time, in Italy, in the late 70s, Italy was under a very repressive government and totally dominated by the Catholic Church, and everything sexually and artistically was just really clamped down. And my friend took me to a number of underground events, and one was showing so-called pornography films, and but they were like coming from Lexington. It was very it was soft porn at the most. I mean, it was, you know, people having sexual relationships, but it was, you know, was like, what? But what I was mostly interested in was the fact that this was considered subversive, and the arts community, the underground arts community, was really addressing important things to them at that time. So when I came back to Lexington, I started an arts cooperative with two other people, Kathy Reese and Doug somebody. I can't remember his last name. He kind of disappeared pretty quickly. And we started this arts collective, which is how, you know, I met a lot of the underground arts community, including the underground gay arts community in Lexington in 1978, 79. And so that kind of broadened my sense of what was going on in Lexington and what was possible. And I was actually very excited about it because at that time I wasn't really aware that there was this really vibrant underground gay community. Well, it wasn't just strictly gay, but it was some of the more powerful figures were, you know, Bob Morgan, and eventually Bradley came along, but Henry Faulkner. And so it was really a lovely experience, although that's not my first experience of gay culture or gay community. My mother's cousin, who she was very fond of, he lived in, as children, he lived in Pigeon Forge. No, not Pigeon Forge. What's the town up in the mountains above Pigeon Forge?
Gatlinburg.
He lived in Gatlinburg. And my mother and her sisters would go visit his family in the summers, and they were very close. And we called him, even though he was probably a third cousin from me, we always called him Uncle Junie, and he was gay. And my mother would say occasionally that he was homosexual. And she and my father would go visit. He became a professor at Emory, one of the universities in Atlanta. And he had a gay partner, and my mother and father would go visit them every once in a while. And so I knew that I had family. It was one of those situations where you knew that he was homosexual. It wasn't really discussed. It was, you just didn't discuss people's sexuality back then, no matter what it was. So that was really one of my first understandings that, okay, you know, this is all right.
Yeah. How old would you have been when you sort of first had that realization?
Huh?
How old would you have been when you first had a realization that LGBTQ people existed?
I was in high school, but it was kind of like it was ever present because he was a relative. So it was like, it wasn't like all of a sudden, you know, everybody declares that Uncle Junie is a gay man and he has a lifelong partner. But that actually isn't my first experience of gay men. Before we moved to where I graduated from high school, we lived in Buchel, which is a kind of a suburb of Louisville, and it was bordering on a very rural, you know, like there were orchards on the other side of the road, and there was a very kind of a a ranch style house that had a big fence around the back, and it was isolated. It was on Fagenbush Lane and down from the orchards. It had a huge fence around the back. It was very private looking, but me and my gang of friends, which when we were all together, it was probably 12 of us that were pubescents and pre-adolescents, you know, basically roaming the area in the summertime because we didn't have anything to do. But, you know, you put a big fence around somebody's backyard and the kids are going to, you know, try to figure out what's behind the fence. So, you know, one hot summer day, we, you know, we're walking and we, you know, we come across this house and you know, the fence didn't keep us out. There was a pool there. And so it was like, man, we've got this private pool because they clearly worked, you know, in the daytime. And so we would go in the late mornings and early afternoons and go splash around their pool and act like we knew what to do with their little bar that was set up in the back. And I think the second day the third day that we had returned to swim in their pool, the back door opened and there was a guy standing there and we were like, oh shit. All kind of, you know, crept out of the pool and just kind of like, oh, what do we do now? Because, you know, we don't have time to get back over the fence without them seeing us. But he came out and introduced himself and talked to us in a very, you know, calm way and very kind. And so we all kind of gathered up our stuff and he invited us to come through the house in order to leave. And you know, he was showing us stuff and in the house and you know, he's being very kind. And I realized later that, one of the things we did do is we looked through his mailbox and saw that one of them had left a note for the other to do shopping. And it was clearly a man's name. And it was looked like, you know, a man's writing to a man's name. And so we knew that it was men. They were very kind and very gentle. And I mean, we were kind of, you know, ruffian. And they let us out and we never went back, but I always felt like that we were treated very well and that they were homosexual men. You know, I knew mm-hmm. that they were homosexual men. So that, you know, I was probably 11.
Yeah. Okay.
So there, that's kind of the earliest memory.
So, just to clarify, it sounds like you were in Lexington like maybe three times, all sort of geared with going to UK. But it's really after that study abroad in Paris, the time you spent in Italy on your return that you became more associated with Lexington's, as you mentioned, through your artistic endeavors. Right, this sort of underground that overlapped with members of the LGBTQ community.
Yeah, although at the same time, before that, after being divorced and going back to Lexington to figure out what I wanted to study and all that stuff, I was taking art history classes and film criticism classes. And in art history, it was very clear that a number of my colleagues or fellow students were gay men, at least. I had women friends that were, you know, that were lesbian. I would have, this while studying art history, and I knew I had women's dinner parties, and it was all women, and a lot of them were my lesbian friends who I knew, you know. So, you know, it's all I became active in the arts community when I came back from Paris. But when I was, you know, studying art history and stuff, a lot of my friends, a lot of my women friends were lesbians.
Mm-hmm. The so how, just to clarify, how do you identify in terms of your own sexual identity?
I'm basically heterosexual. You know, never really experimented very much sexually, you know. Yeah. I mean, I guess my position is that I could be bi, but I don't, you know, I've never really indulged in it.
Right, yeah. You know? So it sounds like your introduction really to the LGBTQ community in Lexington really was through school, through your art courses, and then later through your own work. So to get to sort of the central, you know, sort of sticking point of the interviews, you know, the country being the bar itself. And so it would have opened, you know, I don't know, about 6 months or so after you got back from Paris. How did you learn about the country? What's your first memory of it? Do you remember?
let's see. I worked for Mary Jane Gallagher. After I came back from Paris, I was kind of scrambling around trying to find work, and I got some temporary work with Cedar Money, with a design agency. And then Mary Jane Gallagher, who was a kind of a public relations person for Kentucky coal companies and horse breeders and horse farms, she hired me, and she had a relationship with a professional relationship with a printing company, which is a very famous one there, called they distributed the voting machines in Kentucky, but a woman that worked at the printing company, Dorothy Casey, would come around, and Mary Jane was very fond of her, and I got to know Dorothy pretty well, kind of well, and she was a lesbian, and so she, you know, I lived like two blocks from the bungalow, so we would meet up there sometimes, or you know, just run. Basically, the way it went is you ran into people, and Dorothy and I became friends, and she asked me one day, do I know about the cutlery?
The cutlery.
No. And so I think she's the one who took me the first time. And then, I was really amazed that it existed, because there weren't that many, you know, women's bars anywhere. And, as far as I knew. And, the second time I went, Kathy Reese and I, we had Creative Forces, the Arts Cooperative, had one of the best cabarets that we had put on. We had put on a number of cabarets over the months. It wasn't years, but over the months, and which Henry Faulkner was at, and Bob, and it was a great event. It was at Breezing's, and we had had this big event, and was, you know, just packed, and you know, lots of entertainment, lots of fun and all this stuff. And I was one of the organizers, But after that, Kathy Reese and I would go out dancing, and there weren't that many places to actually go out and dance. And we went to Breezing's. This was after the cabaret. We both had tuxedos on, and so we were dancing, you know, kind of flinging each other around, kind of being ironic. And and the manager of the bar of Breezing's threw us off. He grabbed us. Oh, actually, people were throwing water on us. And the manager came down from his office and grabbed both of us by our tuxedo collars and threw us off the dance floor and said, "We're not going to have this here." Now I thought, oh, so it's okay to have, you know, gay men there, but it's not for women to come and dance together. And so I think it was that night that I don't think she knew about the country, but I took her there, and we were dancing there in our tuxedos, and somebody came up to us and said, "Oh, I don't know where y'all are from, but this is so cool," you know. And that was the second time I'd been there. And then the third time I was there, which was probably is after I'd left Lexington and moved to Covington. Karen Berry was in town from New York, and Jan Smith, me, maybe Sherry Collins. It was a group of us, maybe six or seven of us, went to the country, and it was around Christmas and danced. I didn't dance. I was kind of depressed at the time, but that was the third time and the last time I was there. What I remember about it, it was when Dorothy took me, Dot Casey. We went in, it was really odd. It's like we drove, you know, to Lane Allen Park. It was like this dark, darkened strip mall kind of place. And you went in, the door was open, and it looked like it should have been just empty, deserted. And you walked into the interior of the strip mall, and there were stores with, you know, paper up in the windows, and it was really dark, and I was thinking, God, but it was buried deep inside this strip mall, and it was not very attractive, if I remember correctly. It was really not, it wasn't, you know, after, you know, Bungalow and Johnny Angels, and, you know, it was really kind of, I was really surprised that it was not very attractive, and, so that's kind of my, you know, memory of the place.
Okay. There's a few things in there I'd like to unpack a little bit. Mm-hmm. First, you mentioned that Dot called the country something else, and I don't think I got it clearly. What did she call it?
Country.
Spell that.
Well, the way I saw it when she said it was C-U-N-T-R-Y.
Okay.
I'm not sure anybody else called it that way, you know, but it was.
Was she being intentional, or was it?
I think she was being ironic.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah, because, I mean, the name itself kind of lends. And I noticed that you also called it a women's bar. Is that typically how, like, when people talked about it, did they talk about it as a lesbian bar or as a women's bar?
I don't remember anybody ever talking about it, frankly.
Uh-huh.
But women, I guess the women's bar was an aphorism. Is that the right word, aphorism?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Or lesbian bar. But... yeah, I mean, it was called Women's Bar. And I think that every time I went to a lesbian bar, it was called a women's bar. You know, Karen took me one in New York. And, but, yeah, I don't.
Now, you also mention, you know, a number of other sites of community, you know, the Bungalow, which was mixed, but kind of gay bar. And you also mentioned Breezing's. And what was especially, you know, that story you tell about getting kicked out, what was your perception of Breezings?
Well, you know, well, we had had a cabaret there. It actually, it was owned by, I don't think people knew this, but it was owned by, in one of my last art history classes that I had before I went to France and in Italy, one of the young men there who is a son, was the son of a coal company owner, he talked about how he was opening a bar, a gay bar. Now, he said bar, and he was going to call it Breezing. So he owned it, but he had this guy managing it who was kind of a thug, I think. But and I don't think it was meant to be a gay bar. Although the reason why we had our big event there is because we knew that guy from our art history class. So I don't know that Breezing was actually – I don't think it was a gay bar specifically, but it – certainly welcomed us that night, you know, a lot of gay acts.
Because I think, I was thinking it was Breezings that famously made women wear skirts to the bar that had a dress code.
Well, you know, we were certainly thrown out.
Yeah. Because I think, I'm pretty sure it was Breezings, was it Mike McCormick that owned Breezings?
Could have been. I don't remember his name. Kathy Reese might remember his name.
Lived in a big house on North Broadway.
I didn't know him well. You know, he was in our class, and, you know, that's about it, other than he opening this bar, and we were able to approach him about having our cabaret. Kate Gallion actually approached him about having our cabaret there.
Gotcha. But,
yeah.
But yeah, that bar was sort of notorious for not liking women, that he did not want women to be in that bar. Because there's a famous story about...
Was it?
What's that?
It wasn't a gay bar, was it?
I think it was. I know once in the July 4th parade, their float was a man in drag over a VW Beetle. So his entire dress covered the car.
Oh.
Like this giant Southern Belle in drag going down Main Street.
Well, they sure, well, it was, yeah, it was, I was really shocked. I mean, well, we were dancing and I remember, you know, people throwing stuff on us. You know, I was hoping it was water, but it was probably drinks, you know. But and then he came down and threw us out.
Yeah. Hmm. But yeah, it had that sort of reputation. And I'm also, like, I think there needs to be sort of clarification with the location, because, so in that strip mall, there is sort of like right in the center, like you walk down some steps and it's almost like the basement level. And then there's it's like a two-story strip mall with the top story all facing outside. And then you walk down some steps and you're in like a little interior hallway that businesses open out into. And you're saying the country was one of those businesses in that bottom half?
I have very little recollection about how.
Do you remember anything specific?
By the time we got there, you know, so I. I remember just it being like a long walk into the bowels of this dark strip mall-like building.
Mm.
There may have been steps. I don't know.
You mentioned you don't remember it being particularly attractive. What do you remember being on the inside? Like,
well, they kept it really dark. I don't remember anything. It was really... it was almost, I had the sense that it was almost gritty, that it was just like really bare bones, you know, there was maybe bench seats or, you know, along the wall and tables. And I don't remember it having any kind of attraction, you know, there hadn't really, from what I remember, much effort toward what it looked like inside. unfortunate.
Do you remember any other places in Lexington that were sort of known as women's places, places where women could go that was sort of seen as their own space? Anything similar to the country?
No, we just people's homes, you know, there wasn't, I don't remember. At the same time, I was not part of the kind of inner core of the Lexington lesbian scene. I had a lot of friends that I touched through art and politics, and but I was never really invited to, like I think that a lot of times there were these gatherings at the lake. And there was a real division. I mean, I could, I always felt like I was an outsider, but I could see that there were these divisions of lesbians within town, and they didn't mix with certain others, and there was class involved, and Sherry's farm was a gathering place, you know, Sherry Collins's farm. But in terms of commercial, I don't know. I wasn't aware.
A little bit, you know, those divisions that you saw, how would you describe them? Like what brought about these divisions amongst lesbian women?
I'm not really sure what brought about, but a lot of it was based on, I remember one group was called the Pretty Ones. Mm. And they would tend to have more money. They had, you know, like there was more money floating around in that community. And the community, I guess I call it community of lesbians that I ultimately liked and still stay in touch with were much, well, from my perspective, more intellectual and more interesting artistically and intellectually, and activists were more activists. The other ones were kind of, from my perspective, more hedonistic.
And that activism is, so when it sort of goes to the country, did you see the country as a bar that was sort of more geared towards one group as opposed to the other? Like you mentioned, it was gritty and not very, doesn't seem like a place where the pretty lesbians would go.
You know, I really don't know. I mean, in a way, when I see it in my mind, it's like it's dark. I can see my friends there, you know, around a table, but there's just nothing remarkable about the so I don't know who went there. I mean, I went there with Kathy Reese, who is not gay, and Dot Casey, who is gay, and my kind of circle of friends that are gay and, well, I make it mixed, I guess. But so it seemed like an acceptable place for a lot of people to go to. Like Jan Smith went there, you know, and she was kind of part of the pretty gay. She crossed lines, but she was part of that rich kind of pretty gay culture or community. I hope you don't take this too seriously, because I don't really know anything.
No, I think it's really, well, part of it is, so some of the folks that have been interviewed, you know, it really was pretty central, you know, to the way they were living their lives, you know, that bar.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And, but I mean, it sort of makes sense. It's the only, you know, it was the only place, you know, so for people to really sometimes gravitate towards it. But at the same time, you know, it shows the diversity. Here you are with a lot of folks, and it doesn't register as much within, you know, the group that you're hanging out with.
Well, you know, I was part of, I, you know, I lived downtown. I mean, I lived at 122 North Upper Street. Downtown was my world. You know, I didn't, you know, unless I went to a film out in the South Side Theater, whatever it was, I didn't leave downtown. So it wasn't a place that I would have gone to by myself, or even, I mean, I had the bungalow two blocks away.
Gotcha.
I could meet, you know, everybody I wanted to see there, you know.
Right. And that's interesting, because that's something that really hasn't come up before, was its location. You know, the fact that it is out there, like, you have to be going to the country.
Yeah.
Go to the country. Like, it's not a place you're going to stumble into. Did you ever go there, you know, when Johnny Angel, before Johnny Angel, during the fire, when everything was closed down, and they opened a bar in that in-between time, that's where they opened it, was in that same space.
As the country?
Yeah.
Oh, see, well, see, in my mind, it was just closed. I wouldn't know. if it wasn't open down on Main Street, then it was, for me, it was closed. I didn't go to the Burbs.
Right. No, and that's a big, because of course, access means, you know, one of the interesting things, you know, that's coming up about the country is race, you know, and, you know, the fact that no one remembers any Black women ever being there, you know, that it, you know, pretty much being a white only bar. And part of that was probably dealing with transportation and access issues. Like,
yeah, I mean,
take a bus to go to the.
I mean, it wasn't where it wouldn't, even if I did go out into the, what I considered the suburbs, it just wasn't, it wasn't a place where I wanted to spend time, because it wasn't, it was so dark. I mean, you couldn't really have, like at the bungalow, you could actually have a conversation with people there. You know, it was a very, you know, social space. And I didn't remember the country as being a place where you could actually talk to anybody. It was, you know, it just seemed too, functional or utilitarian. So I don't know why, you know, I don't know.
So where did, you were talking about, you know, you were hanging out mostly with the lesbian women you were hanging out with tended to be artsy activists, political. Where were they hanging out? Like, where would they go?
Well, bungalow. now, you know, this isn't a huge group of people. I mean, it's
right.
A bungalow, and, you know, or, you know, you were in people's homes, you know.
Did you ever make it to any of the sort of communal collective living groups of women? You know, there was the thing Sherry Collins had on West 2nd Street. That was probably a little bit before your time. There was also one, wasn't there, out Nicholasville Road, Offhand Manor? Although I don't know if that one was all women.
I don't, I was friends with Karen, and I think that's when Take Back the Night, Karen lived on Mill Street, but I wasn't around the, what they call it, I forget what they called it, Sherry, the commune or whatever that Sherry was involved in.
I think it's just the collective.
Yeah, I wasn't really aware of that. They kind of made themselves apparent to me after I got arrested for demonstrating against the director of the CIA and Allison So people, you know, introduced themselves to me after that. And that's how I met Jan Carter, I believe, was because she was friends with a lot of the, well, some of the Iranians that had been arrested as well. And so it's like this all the time there, but I knew Sherry before that, but I didn't know about the collective. If I did, it was kind of went by my head because I was probably involved in a lot of other stuff as well.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. At the same time.
So you mentioned, you know, going to the country about three times or so. Do you remember hearing about it closing? Anything about its demise?
I left Lexington in 82, I think. I kept the apartment for till about 83, but I left, I think, in 82 and moved to Covington. So I had kind of put Lexington behind me because I, you know, there were some things that I didn't want to be around anymore in Lexington. And so I just didn't, I kept in touch with a few people. Karen had moved to New York and, you know, it kind of, for me, it all just kind of like, just like that. So the third time I went to the country, I was living in Covington and Karen was back from New York. And that was the last time I even thought about it, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I guess by then it probably would have been called the Hidden Door. It changes its name sort of halfway through with new owners.
Didn't know that.
Well, anything else, June? We're getting right on an hour.
Well, you know, you talking about the collective, I think, yeah, I'm curious. I should ask Karen this about Karen organized, was the main force behind Take Back the Night.
Hmm.
And I wondered, now I wonder if the collective was not helping out with that to some degree. I don't think Karen lived there, but, yeah, so you've raised some questions for me, too.
Yeah. Oh, good, for your own work, yeah. Well, great. Well, thank you very much, Jean. I'm going to stop the recording right now.
Okay, thank you.